You're listening to KCRW Santa Monica, Los Angeles, Orange County, KDRW Santa Barbara, KCRI Indio, Palm Springs, KCRU Oxnard Ventura, and KCRY Mojave in the Antelope Valley, a community service of Santa Monica College, NPR for Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us this evening for All Things Considered. As we continue with more information for you, our Los Angeles listeners and here at KCRW will have Left, Right, and Center in just a few moments. But coming up, if you're listening in Santa Barbara, the 24th Congressional Debate tonight live from the New Vic Theater in Santa Barbara. The candidates for that 24th Congressional Debate will happen for our Santa Barbara listeners at 88.7 up in that area along the Central Coast. And if you want to listen in wherever you are across the Southland, you can stream KCRW Santa Barbara at our app or check it out online at kcrw.com. Have a great weekend. It is KCRW, NPR for Southern California.
Live from the Ensemble Theater Company, the New Vic in Santa Barbara, this is KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian. And in collaboration with the Santa Barbara Independent, I want to welcome our listeners joining us from the KCRW membership drive and our audience to the debate for California's 24th Congressional District. After 20 years of leadership from Congresswoman Lois Capps and her late husband Walter Capps, voters across Santa Barbara and the Central Coast will be electing a new representative. Tonight, we'll hear from five of the nine candidates in the race. They include, from left to right, three Democrats, nonprofit director and farmer William Ostrander, Santa Barbara Mayor Helene Schneider, and First District Santa Barbara Supervisor Salud Carbajal. On the Republican side, District 35 Assemblyman Kacho Ashajian and a businessman Justin Farid. Please welcome the candidates. Well, the rules for tonight's debate are simple. There will be a mixture of questions directed to all the candidates, to specific candidates, and to members of each political party. Candidates will have 90 seconds to answer the questions, and if another candidate is mentioned in an answer, he or she will have 30 seconds to respond. Let's begin the debate. This question is for all the candidates. We'll begin with Mr. Ostrander and we'll work across the stage. In March, ICE officials ordered Bonita Packing Company in Santa Maria to fire hundreds of farm workers because of their immigration status. It's been estimated that the vast majority of farm workers in Santa Barbara County are undocumented. At the same time, this comes when there is a 25% labor shortage in the district. Do you believe that we should offer these workers a path to citizenship?
Absolutely. I am a farmer. And for those of you that don't know what a regenerative farmer is, I'm a carbon farmer. I put carbon in the soil every day. That's part of what generative farming does. It actually helps to regenerate carbon in the soil, so we work on improving the soil. There is a labor shortage. I've felt it. There is a problem with our H-2A visa program for farm laborers. It becomes very complex. Many, many farmers are trying to use it, but there's an awful lot of people that just get sick of the paperwork. And then there's a lot of people that come across the border that want to have employment that aren't documented. But one of the things that I want to ask you about these workers is how many of you appreciate your cheap food policy? Our cheap food policy is dependent upon illegal immigrants, to be honest with you. We don't like that. We think they're taking our jobs, but the fact of the matter is most Americans don't want to bend over and cut cilantro and pick broccoli and pick berries. So Americans have to kind of make up their decision, not just about immigration, but about food and about other things where we're using immigrant labor. Harvard did a study and found out that immigrants in this country give all of us approximately a 1% net increase in our value, in our overall worth. Excuse me. We need to give a path to immigrants to come out of the shadows, as the Democratic talking point goes, and give an opportunity to participate in the American dream, to give them education, to help them contribute, and they can turn contribute to our programs of Social Security and Medicare.
Thank you. Helene Schneider.
Thank you, and first thank you to everyone who's here today and to those listening, the very important debate here. there is a problem here, and I think it's symptomatic of a decades-long problem with the whole immigration system that needs reform. And so I think that what has to happen on a federal level is comprehensive immigration reform that includes a variety of things. It includes securing the border, and it also includes allowing people to have a pathway to become legal residents, at least, and if not citizens, as part of the conversation. The other thing that's going on that happened right here in our district just a few weeks ago was a terrible incident that may be arson up in the Napomo area, where farmers were trying to do the right thing by supplying housing to their farm workers through the visa program, and while they were building their facility, the housing, it was burned down, and they're suspecting arson. The type of rhetoric we're hearing throughout the country about immigration, about immigrants, and about the other as a way of really, really vague, looking at these ways as that in a racist kind of issue has to stop. We have to value people who are here, value the work that they do, and stop the rhetoric. And as a national conversation, we have to do it in a way that is constructive, in a comprehensive way. And I think it's something both Democrats and Republicans on the Hill have said they wanted to do, and it's time to get the action done and do it finally.
Thank you. Mr. Carbajal.
Thank you very much. Absolutely. I think what we need is comprehensive immigration reform, as my two opponents have stipulated. Look, I'm a son of a farm worker. I immigrated to this country when the immigration system worked. But the fact of the matter is many people have come to this country seeking opportunity because the system doesn't work and they haven't come through the legal channels. We need comprehensive immigration reform in a way that provides a path to citizenship, certainly secures our borders, but also make sure that we are allowing these people to come out of the shadow so they could continue to contribute to our economy. Far too long we've had this rhetoric in Washington, this bickering, and not really the bipartisan work that we need to have to finally pass comprehensive immigration reform. One of the things that I would do in Congress is I would work with ICE. I would work with all our stakeholders, our farmers, and say, just like the president has promulgated some executive orders for DACA, DAPA, and the Dreamers, we need to make sure that we understand that there's a shortage of workers for our agriculture industry. And we need to allow those workers to not live in fear and to come to work and contribute. We need to have a pause on the raids that we're seeing in Santa Maria. So we do need comprehensive immigration reform. And we can do it in a bipartisan fashion, as was demonstrated by the United States Senate with S-15.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ashajian.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you all for attending. The most valuable asset I have in my possession is my citizenship. I'm glad that I work hard and went through the process to earn it. If it was just given to me, I don't think it would be as valuable. So I think everybody who chooses to become a U.S. citizen, there is a process for him or her. We need to bring back the Becerra's program and our guest workers permit to have in place. What happened in Santa Maria is a proof that E-Verify does not work and that we have a shortage of farm workers. And those are jobs that are not taken away from our kids. Not everybody wishes to be in the fields and work as hard as those ladies and gentlemen do. Very hard workers want to earn an honest living. Having said that, we have to find a legal way to be sure that they're here legally. We know who they are, where they are, and find a way for them to gain access to the United States because they do want to go back. And without visas, they won't be able to do that. And the reason they don't go back because coming back is much harder. So if they have the permits to work here, they'll be able to travel back and forth. There won't be a need to bring their families here because they want to back to their own country. So I believe that to help our farmers, we need to look favorably into these programs to be sure that they're here in a way that they're welcomed and it's legal. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. And thank you for all of you for being here this evening. I'm honored to be in my hometown to have an opportunity to discuss the issues with everybody here on this stage. Immigration is a significant issue that has existed and been perpetuated in politics for several decades now. It has not been solved, and we hear a lot of buzzwords like comprehensive immigration reform and that it's necessary and that it can be done. But we have a system that exists in Congress today that is so political, makes it very, very difficult to get anything done. And so I think we got to examine this systemically and foundationally. That's why I believe that we should move to a single subject rule and handle this on a step-by-step basis, securing the borders first and having every policy that's considered moving forward be merit-based and work to really benefit the economy. So having a seasonal, well-monitored guest worker program, I think, is something that we should consider and have discussions over. We do have a significant labor shortage going on in our agriculture arena with our growers and our farmers and our ranchers throughout the Central Coast and really throughout California. One of the things that happened when Department of Homeland Security came in and told all these workers that they had to leave and they had to be fired, they didn't have any place to go. There was no plan of action after that. So this isn't a solution to a problem. This actually had detrimental effects, and we need to have long-range plans and solutions to these problems, and that has to happen on a step-by-step basis. This is how I believe we'll break the gridlock, and we'll handle it issue by issue.
Thank you. We'll now move to individual questions to candidates. Mr. Ashajian, the Salud Carbajal campaign released a message condemning your support of oil extraction. They say that you've profited from oil drilling by the simple fact that you own 3 gas stations. At the same time, environmentalists are concerned that oil drilling is getting more hazardous. Oil corporations are now fracking in the Santa Barbara Channel. If elected, would you support on- and offshore fracking across the district?
Mr. Cabal did that? I do support fracking as much as I did support last year a bill that, for the first time, we put regulations in place for fracking purposes. Oil drilling, it can be very safe due to today's technology. The accident that happened in Santa Barbara is not acceptable. Those valves should have been in place to shut them off when there was a need to. You may ask the question, how many people walk here today or drove their cars and needed gas? Yes, I own a gas station. I'm a proud owner and operator. I work very hard to buy my first one. I had to work in one of them to put myself through college. Upon graduation, I bought to stay local, then free enterprise got me where I am. I'm very proud of what I do. I work for a living, and that's what it is.
So that's a yes on and offshore fracking support, yes.
Yes.
We'll move on to Mr. Carbajal. Helene Schneider criticizes the fact that you often play it safe politically. One phrase you often use is win-win, but that can also be interpreted as you lacking a set of firm beliefs and doing what it takes to stay in good standing with voters and the Democratic Party. Give us one example when you took a risk, when you stuck your neck out on a position that was too important to compromise on.
Well, I'll give you more than one example. One is offshore oil. I've always been a leader and at the forefront of making sure that we don't allow continued drilling off our coast. Two, on Measure P, I took a leadership role in supporting that measure because it was going to address some real challenges and impacts that fracking would have in our county. And it was an initiative to ban fracking. Thirdly, I took a position against Measure M that was going to undermine our ability to continue funding safety net programs in our county. And instead, what did we do after I helped defeat Measure M? I turned around in a bipartisan fashion with my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors on a 4-1 vote, and we approved $100 million invested in our roads and parks over the next 10 years. Those are just a few. I could continue.
Thank you, Mr. Carbajal. We'll continue now to Mr. Fareed. You often highlight the fact that as the youngest candidate in the race, you're the voice of the next generation. However, you have no experience holding a position of leadership in government. What do you say to those who do not believe you are qualified to be a congressman?
I think leadership exists at all levels of government. When you talk about Congress, which you're supposed to have is 435 servant leaders that are not necessarily politicians. What I find, at least in my experience, so often is that politicians are very much nearsighted because the culture is really developed with the short-term interest of the reelection efforts. This affects policies and how they'll affect us 10 years from now or 20 years from now. And this is why I think we see nearly a $19.5 trillion debt in this country, which is going to mean a future of more debt, higher taxes, fewer jobs, and a lower standard of living for future generations. We're seeing a lot of job creation being stifled by the cost of regulation, the cost of taxes for small businesses throughout the Central Coast and, frankly, throughout the country. This is a big problem. I think you have to look at the totality of one's background and experience. I grew up here in Santa Barbara, building a business from scratch with my family, packing boxes, taking inventory, going to different chambers and trade shows. Vice president of that business today, we've seen a lot of the impacts that may be well-intended, but they have detrimental impacts for small businesses like ourselves to not only stay alive, but thrive in this type of environment. So I think it's important to recognize that in order to make a difference, you have to have the desire, the drive, the energy, and the vision to make it happen.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ostrander, similar to Justin Fried, you have no history of governmental leadership. You worked for years as an actor and now operate a farm in San Luis Obispo, among other things. What makes you confident that you have the experience and ability to be an effective congressman?
Well, first of all, let's understand that the House of Representatives is the shortest term in Washington. It is 2 years. And the Founding Fathers' specific intent was this, was that all of us rotate in and out of government because we are supposed to re-envision and reconsider where we're at. The fact that you are not dog catcher before your city, sorry, school board member before your city council member, et cetera, is not relevant in this race. Most of you don't know that there's 35 to 85 people that occupy one of those offices. It has a turnover rate every 2 years and has for the last 230 years. It is somewhat immune or at least gauged to take in new blood. And my concern is that some of these people up here have absolutely no private sector experience, which I think in some respects is more disqualification than anything. Secondly, I have been working outside of government for many years, and unlike any of these other people up here, I've actually given a congressional briefing. I have lobbied 65 offices of the House and Senate on issues of campaign finance reform. I have spent time in Washington, and I've spent time outside of Washington. I've done both, and I understand both. And today, it frustrates me to hear some of the talk that goes on up here, which is disingenuous. Most of us believe that Congress is not working. There's 14% approval rating. And then you have Mr. Fried over here telling you that he's the only non-politician running when 6 out of the 9 people are non-politicians.
Okay.
I could go on. And I will.
You have 30 seconds if you'd like to respond.
Outstanding. A few years ago, I worked for a senior member of Congress. It was my job on a number of different issues, from foreign policy to small business to agriculture to commerce, manufacturing, and trade, to bring a consensus among members and move that policy. But it was really there in that experience that I saw all that's wrong with Congress today. And again, I go back to the nearsightedness that exists with it. It's not a functional institution, and this starts down at the core with the budgeting in Congress. And I want to get into those reforms moving forward.
Okay. A question now to Helene Schneider. A number of prominent women's groups have supported your opponent, Salud Carbajal, including Santa Barbara Women's Political Committee, the Democratic Women of Santa Barbara. As the only female in the race, are you worried that you've lost the support of women voters?
Well, first, I want to make one thing clear in that I don't think people should vote for anyone based if they're a woman or a man. I think you should vote for me because I think you need to vote for the best candidate. And I think I am that best candidate in part because I bring a perspective of a woman to a place where there's only 19% of women who are in the House of Representatives, and to bring that perspective. The Santa Barbara Women's Political Committee did not make an endorsement in that race, to clarify your comment. There are a number of people throughout the community, National Organization for Women, the National Women's Political Caucus, a series of members from currently on the board and past presidents of both Democratic Women and the Santa Barbara Women's Political Committee, who are not only supporting the campaign, but actively working to help me get elected. And I believe the issue here is, what are the issues that people care about related to gender equality? Who's the person who has done the most on those issues related to reproductive health care, family leave, paid issues related to women in the workplace, and who's the one who's been the strongest voice on that issue? And I've had 25 years of experience both on city council, as mayor, as working at Planned Parenthood in the Human Resources Department, and as an advocate for those issues throughout my professional career. This is something that is in my blood. It's what brought me to politics to begin with. And I'm so appreciative that women and men from throughout the 24th Congressional District see that leadership and want to see me elected.
Thank you, Ms. Schneider. We'll now continue for a set of questions directed to the Republican candidates. Mr. Fareed, you've said that you would support any Republican presidential candidate by the time the California primary rolls around. Mr. Ashajian has been less clear on this subject. My question is a simple one here. If Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for president, which it appears he is because there are no other candidates in the race right now, will you support him in the general election? Mr. Ashajian, we'll begin with you.
I thought you were addressing Mr. Fareed. I will support the Republican nominee, whoever that might be, even though for the time being we're talking about Mr. Trump, but surprises are to be.
So you will support Donald Trump if he is the Republican nominee?
He is the Republican nominee, I will.
Okay.
It's challenging times, but I'll be happy to work with him and teach him better.
All right. Mr. Fareed?
Well, I think you got to look at our options here on either side of the aisle. It's hard to find a word to describe it. I think more than anything, this shows how important it is to have Congress working again for the American people, because that is the body that's geared to lay the directive, set the policy, set the tone, and how we're supposed to be governed as a country. And it's not happening like that very much anymore. And it's because of the dysfunction that exists in Congress. And that's why I believe if you have a healthy Congress, no matter
who is in the presidency, Donald Trump or not.
I've got 54 more seconds, Jonathan. So I'll come back to
that. Okay. I'll be waiting for it.
And you'll get it. 46 seconds. The most important thing that we need in a president is one that will work with Congress and faithfully executing the policies that are created by Congress, to not treat it as a suggestion, to not try to rule through executive order or through regulations or rules that really circumvent the process with the people. We're the ones who feel the effects of that. So I will work with any president who is holding that office that is elected by the people
and
the majority
of the people. So if it's Donald Trump, you will actively support him?
I'm not sure what that means, actively
would
support.
Would you campaign for him? Would you tell your constituents to vote for him?
I'm campaigning to represent the people of the Central Coast. Will I vote for him? Time will tell.
Okay. We'll now move on to the Democratic candidates here. Recent studies have shown that on average, college students graduate with roughly $30,000 in student debt. This comes at a time when more and more people are attending college nationwide. Do you support the plan by Bernie Sanders to make public universities tuition-free? Mr. Carbajal, we'll begin with you.
I think that's a wonderful aspirational goal, and I hope that we can get there someday, as other countries have done. But from a pragmatic standpoint, what I believe that we can do in the meantime to make our higher education system better is make it more accessible and affordable. And what I think we need to start is making sure that our community colleges are tuition-free, as the president has proposed. Two, we need to expand financial aid and Pell Grant opportunities. And third, we need to make sure that we are lowering the interest rates that people are having to shoulder when taking out loans for their higher education. And they also need to have opportunities to refinance their debt, like people can refinance their mortgage. And lastly, I think we need to provide opportunities in public service so that those that do wind up shouldering and having a burden of debt can write off that debt by working in public service in one of many careers throughout our country. I think we need to do those things sooner rather than later, and someday perhaps aspire to the aspirational goal that Bernie Sanders has laid out as a challenge to our country to get there sooner rather than later.
And so for four-year universities, UC Santa Barbara, Cal Poly, would you say those should be tuition-free as soon as possible?
I would say if we can achieve that through a good financial plan that allows us to do that, it's a matter of balancing all our interests.
Okay.
I would like to get there.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Schneider.
Thank you. As it is in California, I'm sure in other states, a lot of the public universities are also funded through state budgets as well. So I think for the federal government to be able to tackle that entire financial burden, I think is very difficult. It would be ideal, of course. But I do think that we do need to do things that actually Supervisor Carbajal mentioned before that I've mentioned many times in terms of being able to refinance student loan debt, be able to assist people who go through both four-year colleges and into graduate school to be able to give back into the community and to help them redo the debt, that pay off their debt that way. I knew that at Planned Parenthood through people who are getting their nurse practitioner license, that that was a way for them to go into underserved areas to give back in that way, get their loans forgiven while giving service to places that needed it. We need to make sure that there are enough opportunities for financial aid, for grants, and we need to make sure that when students are in college that they have the capability to have the fullest possible potential they have in order to learn and get a full degree without fear of being harassed, discriminated against, or being sexually assaulted. Those are issues that are practically just as important as it is about financing your student education.
Thank you. Mr. Ostrander?
Thank you. It costs $140,000 to get an undergraduate degree at UCSB for an in-state student. That's absurd. Many of you out there, I can see, are of an age when you remember when California's education system was free or nearly free. I think it's important that you recognize that what Mr. Sanders is saying is that we recognize that there's a value to education for people who are 5 years of age to 18 years of age. And then suddenly we say, nope, you're on your own. The last time we raised the standard for education was in 1915 when we asked cities to have high schools. And they ran to have high schools because they recognized that that was the key to upward social mobility for most Americans at a time when we were manufacturing airplanes and cars and plumbing equipment and telephones and things like that. Today, we're going to the moon. We have computers. We're doing stem cells. Why are we choosing not to invest in our own human resources? It makes no sense. We have defunded post-secondary education by 40% since 1980, and it's a choice. These are legislative choices, people. And we've decided that now you guys should do it on your own. We've got ours. You guys should do it on your own. It is three times harder to go to school today than it was when Mr. Ashajian went to a California school in the 1970s. Why? Other countries recognize that investment and make it in their students. Do you know for every $1 post-secondary education returns $13 to the public economy in the state of Virginia? It's a good investment.
Okay, thank you. And I want to remind our radio listeners, you're listening to a live debate for the 24th Congressional District at KCRW Santa Barbara, 88.7 FM and KCRW.com. We're live on stage with five of the candidates running for Congress here at the Neuvik Theater in Santa Barbara. This is a general question to all the candidates, beginning with Mr. Fareed. This winter's El Nino storms did not bring the necessary amount of rain to lift Southern California from a drought. Following Governor Brown's orders, cities like Santa Barbara continue to cut their water use. However, it's been estimated that 80% of water in the state goes toward agriculture. So therefore, should we be asking farmers and not necessarily cities in the 24th Congressional District to make changes? And if so, how?
I'm going to work my way backward to forward on that question. There is a false statistic because 50% of the water in the state of California is run off to the ocean. So saying that farmers or ranchers or agriculture are using 80% of the water, the reality is between 35 to 40% of the state's water. So that needs to be clear and accurately disseminated to the public. Secondly, what we've seen with this current drought is that there has been so little foresight from past and current politicians in investment in infrastructure towards water. We have the technology and things like desalinization. We're just opening up ours here in Santa Barbara, and I commend the mayor and the city council working to get that back up and going. Congratulations and thank you. Secondly, we need to be able to invest into water treatment facilities. And thirdly, there hasn't been a reservoir built in the state of California since 1979. They've had 30 different reservoirs decommissioned and taken down in that same time period. There's over 15 million more people here in this state now than there were then, and California is the breadbasket of the entire world. We need to invest in this, and we can't rely on potential El Niños because they may or may not show up in a certain year, and we can't predict how long a certain drought will last. So we need to invest in our future, and that's an infrastructure for water moving forward, no question.
Mr. Ashajian?
Water conservation starts with you and I and everybody in this room. We do our share. I don't want to blame our farmers because farming is number one industry in both counties, Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. We need to ask our farmers what else we can do to help them out. When El Nino hits us, the water gets washed to the ocean. The question should be, what can we do to save that water? Such as building new reservoirs, no storage, new storage. Last year, Californians approved $7.54 billion in water bond. We haven't done anything with it yet. $2.7 billion of that money is put aside, designated for new storage. We're working very closely with the governor to help us expedite the CEQA process in order for us to build. Otherwise, as much rain we get, we're not going to see any benefit because it's going to get washed to the ocean. Desal plants is a must. When I was served on the Coastal Commission, we approved the Carlsbad desal plant, billion-dollar water desal plant, which helped create jobs, and today it's the least expensive way of getting water. In Los Osos, when I was on the Board of Supervisors, we approved the sewer treatment, and all the recycled water now goes to help the farmers. So there is a way to do it. It's the will of the people and the will of those who are elected to their offices, city, county, statewide, to make it happen. So there are ways. We just need to work harder.
Thank you. Mr. Carbajal.
Thank you. Well, I think it's unfortunate when we start pitting one group against another. We do have challenges. I think what we need to do is start working over our boundaries of purveyors and really trying to come up with water security comprehensive plans. The state of California recently promulgated legislation requiring local jurisdictions to come up with comprehensive plans, management plans, to address high-priority overdraft water basins. That's one approach. But I think we need to work together to just make sure that we're addressing our water security issues comprehensively. One, conservation. Two, recycle our gray water and make sure that we have opportunities to do so. We also need to make sure that we are allowing for recharge, that the federal government should be able to incentivize local jurisdictions to work across those boundaries by incentivizing those efforts of collaboration. We also need to make sure that the federal government is incentivizing the state of California and local communities with funding for infrastructure so that we could use that recycled water in ways to maximize our potable water in our communities.
Yeah, but I've heard you say, Mr. Carbajal, before, for example, at Cal Poly, that we're growing very water-intensive crops in places they should not be grown. Is that part of the answer as well or not?
Well, I certainly think we need to look at the practices of agriculture uses to see how we could maximize conservation from those efforts. You've also heard me say that I'm also open to environmentally friendly desalinization. But that's the last resort because it's very energy intensive and it damages our environment. Okay. And the water desalinization plant that we have in our region,
thank you,
while it's a good step forward, okay, damages our environment in a really bad way.
Thank you. Ms. Schneider.
Well, I think it's a bigger issue here looking at the full picture of our water use and what we can do to actually extend the value of that water as opposed to it getting runoff through stormwater basins, using permeable pavers like we're doing here in the city of Santa Barbara where it recharges the ground basin. We're expanding that in other places, working with the state to allow for direct potable reuse. So when you have your treated water going through a system, to be able to reuse it again, state law does not require allow for that right now. The issue of desalination, I think, needs to be addressed. There has been so much misinformation about what this particular desalination plant is going to do. It is 40% less energy intensive than the last one that was put together. The screening areas is much more environmentally friendly, and in fact, the research that we're doing right now to look at other alternatives, if we want to look at desalination long term, is something that we are focusing on as we speak. Taking water from the Sierras to Santa Barbara taps is not exactly environmentally friendly either, and it's very expensive. You need to look at things at a big picture level. I also appreciate Senator Feinstein's bill that she's putting forward to put funding into infrastructure, water security, and water management. The way the state works right now is that to pay for this infrastructure, it's on the backs of the ratepayers, and that big infrastructure improvements, we need to have federal funding to that. I have the experience as mayor to make that happen.
What about do you think there should be any changes, though, made by the farmers? And I mean, you're talking about desalination, but this seems to be a separate
subject.
I think
you look at where the runoff is happening. How can you reuse the water? Do you look at how do you deal with crops and over time? Is there ways you can circulate crops and the water usage there? There's, you know, I think it's very important to look at what is the what are the consequences of letting things go fallow in terms of completely killing off the crops that are there, and what is the economic impact of that?
Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. You know, a couple of questions ago, somebody asked, why do you think you belong in Congress? I'm a farmer, and none of these people know what they're talking about. No, Mr. Farid, not 50% of my water goes into the ocean off my ranch. I promise you that. There are many, many, many ways that we can do that actually improve the amount of water that we collect without building damaging reservoirs. But one of the things that Americans need to do is stop saying, I want more, I want more, I want exactly the same, I want more. And there are things that we can do that you wouldn't think are directly relative to saving water, but they are incredibly important. You know, every time a farmer goes through a field and chews up that field with a piece of equipment, it loses 1/3 to 3/4 of an inch of rainfall moisture out of that soil. Not only that, but when we tear up that root system, when the water falls, it comes down and it hits the tilled soil, it's hitting it like a BB, and it makes an impact, and it makes a crust. And it can't get down into the soil to recharge your aquifers. So what happens is it washes off, and it's washing off 4 tons of topsoil per person on the planet every single year. We need to stop tilling everything and constantly tilling and thinking at our land policies. If we were to invest in perennial seeds, if we were to take our farm bill and invest in no-till planters like I own in San Luis Obispo County, if we offered in the farm bill grass cover crops and other types of cover crops that allow water to perforate and get down into our aquifers,
okay,
we wouldn't be in such a mess.
Thank you.
There's many other things, too.
Thank you. We'll now go on to a set of questions directed to specific candidates. Justin Fried, a study by the Pew Research Center finds that 73% of younger Americans, often called millennials, are supportive of gay marriage. This is the exact generation of voters you claim to be representing in your campaign. As a Republican, would you break ranks with many members of your party and openly support gay marriage?
I believe that all people should be treated equally under the law.
Would you like to go on?
Well, in today's day and age, the law says that all people are treated equally in that regard. I would support that.
So you would support gay marriage then?
That's the law, yes.
Okay. Helene Schneider, you've consistently said that you're running as an anti-establishment candidate, yet your highest profile endorsements have come from officials clearly aligned within the Democratic establishment, including Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and our local state senator, Hannah Beth Jackson. You've twice been elected Democratic mayor. Can you explain what you mean by anti-establishment and why it would make you attractive to voters in the 24th District?
Well, a couple of things, and thank you for that question. I believe in Washington, D.C., the establishment there has such a stranglehold on people on Capitol Hill from both parties. The level of money in politics that we see throughout this campaign and throughout the country is creating systems where if you don't pay to play in that situation, you're not going to be able to make deals in that capacity. And I think you're set up in such a situation where if you want to try to win, you have the Washington establishment help you in so much, in so many ways, with so much money, you owe them so much going into it before you're even sworn in. That's a big problem. That is something that needs to be addressed. I am very proud that State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom are supporting my campaign. And if you look at their record and how they've interacted within their Democratic Party establishment, they've actually pushed the envelope more than most people have ever have. Gavin Newsom's not exactly the favorite amongst the governor because he's able to call things out as he sees them. Hannah Beth Jackson, she's the one that put together the equal pay bill that finally people came together to move forward and pass into law. She didn't do that to get along to be nice. She did it because it was the right thing to do, and she had the facts and the wherewithal to make it happen. These are things of pushing the envelope, of saying what's right, of speaking on behalf of your constituents. Mr. Newsom, in the issue with gay marriage, on the issue of voting, the issue
Thank
of
you.
Gun control issues, I applaud his work, and I really value their endorsement.
Thank you. Salud Carbajal. You've been endorsed by current 24th District Congresswoman Lois Capps. Throughout the campaign, you've been asked to list one specific way in which you differ from the policies of Lois Capps, and I have not heard a clear answer on this subject. I would like to give you one more opportunity to explain how your leadership will differ from that from Congresswoman Capps. Please be specific.
Thank you so much for that question, Jonathan. You know, well, first let me, as I answer this question, just tell you how proud I am to have the endorsement of Lois Capps, somebody who has represented the Central Coast with such integrity and such effectiveness. I am extremely proud of her endorsement. You know, Lois Capps and I would approach our decision-making differently. We share different experiences. I am an immigrant to this country. I come from a farm worker family. I've cut my teeth in local government for many, many years, over 24 years. Our approach to our decision-making would definitely be different. One thing that I would disagree with, that I would have voted differently and disagree with Congresswoman Capps, was the 2008 bank bailout, which I think was short-sighted overall. It was a giveaway to the banks. We were certainly enduring a crisis, but there was very little transparency, and I think the bailout was unfortunate, and I would have voted differently than Congresswoman Capps.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Shajian, in 2015, Planned Parenthood was under attack for allegedly selling fetal tissue. This led to renewed pressure from Congress to defund the organization. If you are elected, would you support to defund Planned Parenthood?
Prior to making that decision, I will revisit and view the video that was put out to see what was true or false about it and to make a decision. So what they do a lot of good stuff, and some of the things maybe not so be good. So if there was nothing to be worried about, that video should have been public and let the public decide and do accordingly. But without seeing it myself, I wouldn't tell you that I will defund them or not.
So as of now, unless you see the video, you would not vote either way, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. William Ostrander, to some, your campaign is defined simply as an attack on the current state of campaign finance. But as a congressman, you'll have the opportunity to focus on a wider range of issues than just that. Aside from campaign finance, which other issue would be your number one priority if elected?
Well, it's important to realize that money in politics is the umbrella issue of all of them. So I'll answer your question specifically, but it's a frustrating limitation on the question itself or what I would try to do. So what people do when they go to Congress, and you need to understand this, is they bring their positions of strength, their power of strength. Ms. Capps was a nurse before she became a politician, so 106 of her 237 bills that she originated herself had to do with health care. I've worked in the nonprofit for most of my life, but the area that I'm making a difference in as a professional and as a person of a nonprofit is taking agriculture into the world of climate change, to help people understand that 35% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture, and we can change it. Not only that, but by changing and putting carbon into the soil, we actually increase the soil's fertility, its water-holding capacity, and ultimately its nutritional value, which means the trickle-down is that you people who are eating that food have healthier food. We clean up the air. We don't need more technology. You know, it's amazing. And, you know, Mother Nature did this amazing thing. She figured out this thing called photosynthesis. And it takes carbon and oxygen and separates the two and gives us the oxygen and feeds the microbes with the sugars from the carbon. I would work very hard at the Farm Bill to make sure that we're cleaning up the climate, improving our food systems, and helping our farmers monetize carbon and make a real living.
Okay. Thank you. You're listening to a special live debate for the 24th Congressional District at KCRW Santa Barbara, 88.7 FM and KCRW.com. We're live on the stage with five of the candidates running for Congress here at the Neuvik Theater in Santa Barbara. This is a general question, beginning with Mr. Salute Garbajal, moving towards the Republicans. Governor Brown was recently able to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which will be phased in over the next 6 years. Do you support this measure, which is designed to help lift working class Americans?
Yes, I do. Let me tell you about the minimum wage as I have experienced it. I mentioned earlier I was an immigrant to this country. First we moved to Arizona, then we moved to Oxnard, California, where my father worked as a farm worker. Working on minimum wage then didn't afford my family to have health care, didn't afford us to be able to live outside of public housing. It was a challenging environment. The minimum wage is going to allow millions of Californians to come out of poverty and to have ladders of opportunity to pick themselves out of poverty and perhaps get to the middle class in the near future. I 100% support the minimum wage legislation that Governor Brown supported.
Thank you. Mr. Ashajian.
Yeah, everybody deserves a raise, but I did not support the minimum wage for the reasons that $15, and even the Governor Brown's own office came with the study that it wasn't good for our economy. $15, there should have been some exemptions to those employees who were on training and or nonprofits who have employees that's going to get hurt. Just think that within my 26, 30 employees, I have some making $17 an hour. Now, if somebody comes in new making $15 an hour, I also to raise the other persons so that they feel good about what they do. And that doesn't end there. When your wages are gone up, so does your workers' comps because it's related to your payroll. So there are issues concerned with that. My way of, I work for minimum wage and put myself through college. And if I didn't work for minimum wage, if the governor was going to keep giving me the raises, I don't think I would have valued education and put myself through college and to get an education.
So that is a no. Is that correct? As of now, the bill, no.
Yeah, but I still have 35 seconds, so. So there are reasons to go against it. And there are, I think, our employees, there are some already make $15 plus because they work hard, they take in more responsibilities, and when they earn it, they feel better about it.
Thank you. Mr. Fareed.
Jonathan, I'm learning from you this evening that you want the answer first and then the explanation afterwards rather than the other way around, so I'll afford you that to all of you in this room. My answer would be no, and I'll tell you why. And I also want to point out that the supervisor's never worked for minimum wage, and he's been making over six figures for a very long time. So to say that you understand what that is, I think, is a little bit of an afterthought. But I will say this. The economic interests of how the $15 minimum wage actually impacts people, it hurts people at all sides of this issue. I mean, it hurts the people who are unemployed, that are underemployed. I meet with people all over the Central Coast, from restaurant owners that supply the jobs to small businesses to ranchers all over the Central Coast, and there is not an economic business model that actually fits this policy. And as the assemblyman had mentioned, even Governor Brown himself said this doesn't make sense economically, and furthermore, it undermines the diversity of not only the state of California, but the entire United States of America. The economic vitality, the job market, the type of industries that exist, the type of people that are working is so different depending on where you are that and the cost of living, all of that stuff changes depending on where you are. So to govern it with a sledgehammer, one-size-fits-all policy, I think underestimates the integrity, the diversity of the state and this nation.
Thank you. Mr. Carbajal, you may respond.
You know, I don't know where Mr. Fareed gets his information from, but clearly it's wrong. But let me tell you why I take issue with his statement. For many families out there, it's not theoretical. They're working day in and day out, oftentimes two jobs, to put food on the table, to help their children to get along. And to talk about it in such theoretical ways doesn't do justice to the plight that the residents that I've represented and hope to represent on the Central Coast are experiencing day in and day out. I find that extremely insulting to those families.
Okay. You have 30 seconds, yes.
Supervisor, it was in your financial disclosures and it was also printed in the media, so if any of you have your phones, you could Google it, and that's where I got my information. Furthermore, I think it is important to recognize what I just asserted one moment ago, that the wage needs to be done at a local level if it's going to be done at all, which actually fits the model and the integrity of that area. Santa Barbara's a lot different than Santa Maria. Santa Maria is much different than Morro Bay, and we have to be conscious of that.
Okay, thank you. We'll continue to Mr. Ostrander, the minimum wage.
I'd like to remind the crowd that Mr. Fareed still works for his parents.
Okay. Let's continue. Let's please
the other
continue.
Thing that's important here to understand, and to his point to a degree, is that when wages are raised, when it's in a big city, it's spread out. When you're living in a small community, an impoverished farm community in the Central Valley, it's very difficult to spread out that increase in wage. It's not a perfect system. But since when has American governance ever been a perfect system? Right? Okay. We all know what it costs to live in Santa Barbara, right? It's for a family of four to have basic services, basic needs met, costs $56,000. Let's do the math. $15 an hour times 2,000 hours, which is an average year, that's $30,000. So we need two full-time workers to be able to get to the basic minimum using a $15 an hour wage. It's not a perfect system, but there are too many people. 24.5% of California children are living in poverty. That's not right, and we can do better. So, thank you. And to Mr. Ashajian, I want to remind you, Mr. Ashajian, that the minimum wage was set in the 1960s, and productivity has gone up so much more than actual minimum wage that if we were applying the same scales as we were in the 1960s, that the minimum wage today would be over $20 an hour, not $15 an hour.
Okay. Would you like to respond, Mr. Ashajian?
I don't have a problem the way you put it. If we give cost of living as in time goes forward, it will be much easier than trying to raise it $4 or $5 at a time. Then as you raise the minimum wage, you think that you're going to increase the middle class, but think of those who are on flat income, because our goods are going to go up, but their flat income is not going to go up. So the poor are going to suffer from the high cost of goods to get. And when we have, just see what happened to my industry. There used to be full serve. It went out of the way because of wages. You're going to see more automation because of the wages going up. So be careful what you wish for.
I'd like to respond to that. First of all, you know, I actually like Mr. Ashajian, and he and I often talk about carpooling down here to Santa Barbara from San Luis Obispo, and we could have that conversation, and I'm happy to do that with you, sir. But if you, I want you to stop and remember just for a second, in the last 40 years, America has the greatest income inequality in the world. Compared to all other developed nations, we have the ability to help the poor amongst us. We're choosing not to.
All right, thank you. Ms. Schneider, finally, we get to you, please.
Let me remind you that
we're going to continue. We're going to continue with Ms. Schneider. Thank you. Ms. Schneider.
Thank you. The governor also said when he signed the bill it was the moral thing to do, and it is. $10 an hour now in the minimum wage today is $20,800 if you work a 40-hour work week. Up to $15 an hour, it's going to take until 2022. This isn't happening tomorrow. This is happening gradually over time. It's giving small businesses actually extra time to comply with it. And we have to remember, for people who are trying to live here, anywhere in the state of California, on a minimum wage, will most likely find themselves also needing public assistance. And so what is it that we're really paying for? Would you rather have someone who's able to earn a living wage, be able to give back and put back money back into the economy, or not making enough while they're working full-time, maybe two jobs, trying to keep their family together, and yet still have to go back to public agencies or public for the county, the state, or the federal government for subsidy? You're paying for it. You might as well have it paid for where people can work for themselves and move themselves out of a poverty situation. First thing I did as a city council member when I was first elected was work on a living wage ordinance for the city of Santa Barbara, because we knew that if we are having contracts, city contracts for outside agencies, that we shouldn't also then be perpetuating this issue of subsidizing care because people can't even afford to have a living wage while working for the city. It's not right, and it needs to be addressed on a national level.
Okay, thank you. One thing we are doing is giving fair time, and we have a timekeeper here, and so far, Mr. Ashajian, we owe you some time here according to answers, so this is directed to you. The shootings in San Bernardino have once again raised the question of gun control in America. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is proposing a new law requiring background checks for ammunition, a ban on magazine clips holding more than 10 rounds, and to provide a process for felons to relinquish firearms. Would you support this legislation?
Not entirely. I have my own bill that passed last year, and the governor signed it, that said the Department of Justice has to report immediately those who are convicted of a crime and those who have disturbed mental problems, because it's not just a gun, but those who have access to a gun creates a problem. All the new laws hasn't really done us any good, because it's not the guns again, it's those, because you make laws available to law-abiding citizens like ourselves, but those who have access to guns, none of those laws will apply to. So still guns are available, underground operations, and we need to be careful, as just increasing more laws doesn't going to cure our problem. We need to go after the problem as what's causing it. You look at most of the times that there's been killings, you look at the background of the person who caused the killings and has some kind of disturbance, mentally or otherwise, and those should never have access to guns. One way to look at it.
Well, amazingly, we are reaching the time here of the end of the debate. First, we will have 60 seconds, closing arguments from each of our candidates. Mr. Fareed, we'll begin with you, and we'll work down the stage.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. Thank you for everyone for being here again this evening. I want to address Bill said one thing earlier. I'm very, very proud to be a third-generation rancher here in California, and I'm incredibly blessed to have had an opportunity to grow up with two hardworking and incredibly selfless people. I don't see them in here tonight, but I know they're here, and I'm very proud to be a part of a small family business. It is a big part of the backbone of the Central Coast. The culture that's developed through that, the work ethic, the drive, and the selflessness that comes from that is very much ingrained within who I am, so want that to be addressed first. I want all of you in this room to realize that this is the most important campaign or election period that we have had here in the Central Coast in almost two decades, and frankly, one of the most important that we are going to have moving forward in our country, and that it's necessary that we get involved and invested through the course of this campaign and then course the next 6 months, because it very well will determine the future of our country. Thank you all for the opportunity to be able to serve all of you. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Ashajian.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you all for being here tonight. The issue of me owning gas stations, if it wasn't me, it would be somebody else. So bear with me. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a living proof of there is such thing as an American dream. I want our kids and grandkids to have same potentials, same opportunities to live the American dream. I thank you for that. My experience being self-employed, there was an issue brought forward about who's been in private sector. I've been in private sector now for 38 years. I still own my services, my businesses, and that's our main source of income. I've served three terms as a board of supervisors, and I worked very hard. Before we left, we had $80 million in reserves. I also was serving your needs, not necessarily this part, but Northern Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County as your assemblyman. Times were tough when I went there, $24 billion in deficit. Today we don't have that because of working together hard, Democrats, Republicans, the governors all combined. I will take the same working ethics and experience to Washington to work on your behalf. Thank you for your listening.
Thank you. Mr. Carbajal.
Thank you very much. As I mentioned earlier, I immigrated to this country when I was five. My father was a farm worker. Despite the economic hardships my family faced, I was able to do well in school. I attended UCSB, first in my family to go to college. I joined the United States Marine Corps. I think my wife's in the audience. I have two wonderful children. I met my wife at UCSB. I know what it's like to struggle. For the past 12 years, I've served on the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors. We've done some great things in a bipartisan fashion. Highest rainy day reserve in the county's history. Balance our budget each and every year, invested in our infrastructure, and while at the same time making sure we invested in the essential services for the most vulnerable. We've done this in a bipartisan fashion. I want to be able to take the same approach to Washington, to be able to provide opportunities for working middle-class families, to lift poor families into the middle class, to expand middle-class opportunities, and to grow the economy, okay, to give opportunities to everyone.
Thank you. Ms. Schneider.
Thank you, everyone, for listening and for being here today. And I appreciate if you also want to look at my website at HeleneSchneider.org for a variety of issues. You have a big decision to make and who's going to be in the top two and who's going to be in this top two also about who can actually make it through into the general election. It's going to be a big look at on a national level. And I think my experience both as a mayor, both working in a nonprofit agency, having a background in human resources management, and being a strong voice on the issues for the Central Coast is something I can bring and want to bring on your behalf and bring that connection without having a Washington establishment type of payback that's going to take for someone to get into office. So I think it's when you're looking at strengths and liabilities, you have to look very carefully at all the candidates and see where their strengths and liabilities are. And make sure that, unfortunately, the way politics works in this country is in, when it comes to the general election, people are really going to focus on personal issues and on policy issues. I hope you can focus on what's happening, on the policy, and I hope I can earn your vote. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you, and thank you to all of you. Most of you believe that Congress is not working correctly. We all have a fairly low opinion of Congress. So the importance of this election is whether or not we're going to keep the government that we have, as Robert Reich said, or get the government that we want to have. And part of getting the government we want to have means that you sort out the candidates who are telling you the truth from the beginning. I already pointed out down here, Mr. Fareed is running a commercial, says he's the only non-politician, when in fact there's six out of the nine people are not politicians, and he's been with us for a year. And Mr. Carbajal over here talks about campaign finance reform, and recently he's been spouting off that he's the only person who's been endorsed by End Citizens United. How many of you know that that's a fundraising organization put together by the Democratic Committee? 65% of the $6 million they took in the last year went to consultants and phone lists. Just this week, they bought $136,000 worth of ad buys for this man over here for his stance on the environment.
Time, Mr. Ostrander.
Okay, sorry. I'd love to keep going.
We'll have to end it there. I know this was kind of fun tonight, wasn't it? Actually, we have to end tonight. We can after the broadcast. Yeah. Thank you. For our listeners, a reminder that the California primary is June 7th. You can hear from the remaining candidates next Friday at 7 p.m. on KCRW Santa Barbara. Thank you to our hosts at the Ensemble Theater Company at the New Vic, to the Santa Barbara Independent for co-hosting the tonight. Thank you to our audience for coming out. The debate for the 24th Congressional District was produced by Catherine Barnes. Tonight's live event was produced by Aaron Sine. Our technical director is Phil Richards, with assistance from Tom King, backed by KCRW Chief Engineer Steve Herbert and Assistant Chief Engineer David Green. Thank you. Thank you again to all the candidates. You're listening to member-supported KCRW on air at 88.7 KDRW Santa Barbara. We are Music Culture News, a community service of Santa Monica College and NPR for Southern California. Our radio audience now returns to the music of Garth Trinidad. Thank you for listening and good night.